From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, an article by the Milwaukee Business Journal examines why it's imperative for area companies to not just change, but innovate.
Businesses are really competing in this global, digitally driven marketplace. And for them, that means that they have to be able to move a lot faster than they ever had to before because things are happening a lot quicker in this tech-driven economy.
Then Chicago writer Rebecca Mackay explores family, art, ghosts, and reinvention in her latest novel, The 100-Year House. And Milwaukee singer-songwriter Joe Huber relishes producing his own albums.
Yeah, having complete control is something that's very freeing. I think, you know, there's been times when we've recorded songs back in the day in 357 where it's just like, that was way too fast, that was way too slow. Those problems just don't happen, you know?
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Buzzwords come and go. According to the Global Language Monitor, which tracks English language usage and compiles a yearly list of the top 50 business buzzwords, 2013 was the year of proactive, monetize, transparency, and win-win, among others. Well, interestingly enough, innovate wasn't on that list, but it is a word that gets bandied about quite a lot as well, especially as companies seek to adapt to the speed of modern business. But what does it mean for a business to go beyond the buzzword and to really innovate? The Milwaukee Business Journal recently published an article titled Innovation Beyond the Buzzword that looks at some of the ways that Milwaukee companies are rethinking their business models. The story's author, Allison Botter, is with me in the studio now. Allison, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Innovation, it's one of the buzzwords of business these days, as your cover story tells. Innovate or be left behind seems to be kind of the mantra that a lot of people are following. But let's start with what people mean by innovate. You know, can it mean different things depending on the business?
It definitely depends on what business you have. I joke that innovation is kind of used, you know, everywhere nowadays. It's a bit of a buzzword. So some companies, it seems like you can't just change, you have to innovate. What that means is a different thing for each company. If you're in retail, it means one thing. If you are producing, you know, we talked to Briggs & Stratton. So if you're talking about lawnmowers, it's something completely different. And each company kind of has to define that for themselves.
Well, but how is incorporating change in a business model new? I mean, all businesses from time immemorial have had to adapt to changing conditions or they go out of business. So what makes innovation so important and why are businesses so anxious to kind of latch onto it and show themselves to be innovative?
Well, the reason that buzzword is catching on now is coming out of the recession, the businesses are really competing in this global, digitally driven marketplace. And for them, that means that they have to be able to move a lot faster than they ever had to before because things are happening a lot quicker in this tech-driven economy.
Okay, so basically they feel that they're going to be left behind.
Exactly, yeah. And it's hard because there's so much innovation happening from startups, from online e-commerce platforms, and then you turn around and you have these big bricks and mortar kind of legacy Fortune 500 companies that have to not only deal with their existing day-to-day demands and infrastructure, but they also have to now pivot and be able to respond to these kind of competing startups.
You talked a lot in the article about how businesses are trying to collaborate in order to do both of those things, particularly if they have a bricks and mortar, more old-fashioned type of business. What are some of the ways that Milwaukee area businesses or Wisconsin businesses are trying to straddle these two things?
So part of it is working with those entrepreneurs, kind of integrating that, you'll hear the phrase startup mentality, into the way they operate. So this might mean changing some of the structures, and it might mean working, you know, kind of taking down a bit of the walls that might have been there before between businesses. One example is Kohl's here in Menominee Falls is very intent on being innovative, on responding to these online marketplaces that are challenging their, you know, day-to-day brick-and-mortar structure. And so what they've done is they've set up these, they call them innovation centers. There's one here in Wisconsin. There's also out in California. They're really bulking that up. And the idea is, you know, the day-to-day retail concerns, those will be taken care of. But we need to be looking 3-5 years down the road and really responding to where the market will be as opposed to where it is right now.
It sounds like they're setting up a research and development, an R&D section where they might not have had it before in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. It's a different focus on that, I would say, than we've seen in the past, and one that's maybe a little more urgent now than it has been previously just because of how fast the competition's moving.
Is there a danger, did you find when you were talking to folks, that businesses are innovating just for the sake of looking like they're making change rather than from, say, a well-researched and thought-out plan?
It's definitely what I've heard. You know, there are some companies that really kind of take this to heart and integrate it at all levels. And then there are others who, you know, they like to use the word innovation, but then you look at that in practice, and I certainly won't name names, but it doesn't translate to what you see. It's more of them wanting to say that they're doing this than actually following through and making the kind of big changes and the kind of risk it takes to really innovate within the business.
Well, that leads to my next question, because change is all well and good, but human beings as a species were notoriously resistant to change of any kind, even when it's good change. And one of the quotes that you have in the article is from Barbara Armstrong from Mount Mary, and she says that business must have a culture that says experimentation and failure and ergo change are acceptable in order for true innovation to occur. When you were talking to people, did they give you an idea about how we can overcome our attachment to comfort, you know, to the way things are, to our resistance to change?
Part of the struggle here is that the infrastructure in a lot of these established companies doesn't support that kind of risk-taking and mentality, which can involve failure sometimes. What I've kind of heard is that it kind of starts from the top. The CEO on down has to be really pushing this idea and welcoming the opportunity to, you know, explore new territory, try some new ideas. But beyond that, I talked to Todd Teske, who's over at Briggs & Stratton. His approach was to get very close to the customer, see exactly, you know, what they need, where the pain points are, and try to mitigate risks by being very responsive to that and kind of knowing your audience. And so that's one way to approach it, where you have at least less of a chance of failure. But it's also a matter of changing the company structure so that there is a little time to, you know, start from scratch, tear things up, begin again.
Well, and I think you're also talking about the fundamental difference between a startup and an established company, because startups are by their very nature fluid and things are changing rapidly because you haven't established anything yet. You haven't actually set up structures. So I think you're always going to have some difficulty when you have a bigger, less wieldy organization. It's always going to be harder to change, particularly quickly.
Exactly. And that's the challenges these companies are in their various ways trying to go after. It's hard for them to pivot as quickly because they have, you know, years of infrastructure, years of established practices kind of working against that fast-moving change that maybe a startup would be able to make.
Do you think, though, from what you heard from talking to folks, that being able to pivot quickly is going to be something that all companies are going to have to be able to do, no matter their size?
It certainly depends on the market, but you do certainly see startups coming up and innovating, again, using the buzzword, but, you know, making these changes that these established companies probably should have done a couple years back when the internet sort of hit the scene in the first place. So it's one of those where, you know, with the competition being so agile, they, you know, slowly but surely they're going to have to change.
Are there Milwaukee companies that are establishing new best practices that other businesses are looking to?
I certainly think Briggs & Stratton is one of those good examples. They came out with the lawnmower earlier this year that was so much quieter in the future. Todd was saying they're looking at making the startup noise a little more quiet. So something like that where they're really focusing on the development, on the new product, and on what the customer wants is, I think, a model for some businesses, even if they are in these very, you know, more traditional machine-based manufacturing kind of industries.
Well, and also a decent size. Briggs & Stratton is not small.
Exactly.
So, you know, they've got a lot of people and a lot of departments to bring along, you know, in that. So maybe other larger companies can look to them as a, you know, a model.
Yeah, I think that's the hope. And that's one where with the Innovation in Milwaukee initiative through the Greater Milwaukee Committee, Todd with Briggs & Stratton is part of this, as is Manpower Group. And most recently, Mike Lovell from Marquette University joined the team there. And their idea is to really make all of those, you know, changes and practices a little more transparent, a little more accessible, and to bring together the different companies, different entrepreneurs in the community, and try to kind of move forward together. So, you know, it's not that these companies are in a bubble trying to figure out their own, you know, new practices. There's at least some guidance and some community resources coming together around that.
And also that collaboration that you spoke about earlier, the idea that we're all in this together, you know, what is it, rising tides float all boats?
Right, exactly.
Something like that. So what's the takeaway message for you from this?
I think the takeaway is to, you know, for these big companies to really seriously look at what they mean when they say the phrase innovation. Like I said, it's the buzzword of the day. Everyone is saying it. But what that means in practice, you have to figure out what that means for your company and how you really can respond quickly and appropriately to these kind of changing and challenging markets.
Well, Allison Botter, thank you so much for stopping by this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Allison Botter is a reporter who covers small business, startups, technology, finance, and education for the Milwaukee Business Journal. Her article, Innovation Beyond the Buzzword, is in the current issue. There's a link to it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, Chicago-based writer Rebecca Mackay chats with us about her new novel ahead of her appearance at Boswell Books this evening. So stay tuned. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. How do we learn who we are or who we aren't? How big a role does our family play in who we become? And how much can we successfully rewrite our own histories? The possibility of reinvention lies at the heart of Rebecca Mackay's newest novel, The 100-Year House. Part mystery, part family drama, part ghost story, and wholly engaging and entertaining, The 100-Year House is set in a fictional house in the Midwest that once housed an artist colony, and which still has many, many secrets a century later. The novel also tells its stories in reverse, starting from the year 2000 and moving backward in sections to the beginning in 1900. The reader ends up knowing the full story, even as none of the characters do. Rebecca Mackay lives in Chicago, and she'll appear at Boswell Book Company tonight to read from and to discuss The 100-Year House. But she's with us in the studio now. Rebecca, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The 100-Year House, I have to say, right up front, I loved it.
Oh, thanks.
I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I want to actually start at the end, and it's actually not even part of the book. It's part of the acknowledgments, where you say that the book started out as a story about male anorexia, and you don't know what happened after that.
Yeah, just so that we don't get accused of false advertising, right. There's no male anorexia female anorexia anywhere in the book. Yeah, that's what it was. About 10 years back, I started a short story that was largely about these two couples that had moved in together in a coach house, a small sort of chauffeur's house on a large estate. And the man of one of the couples was anorexic, and the man in the other couple was the only one who noticed and was trying to get everyone to realize what was going on. It did not work as a short story, but what I loved about the setup and why I came back to it then a few years later was this idea of the smaller house on a large estate. How 100 years ago, those little places were built, especially in the Midwest, get them a lot down in Chicago where I am, some of the suburbs up in Milwaukee here, you have some too. They were built as houses for chauffeurs, servants. Now that's not who lives in it at all. No one has a chauffeur anymore. And even if you're a billionaire, it's in-laws now. It's you rent it out to people. And I like the idea of that changing relationship over time between the people in the little house and the people in the big house. And I like the characters I had. But yeah, the anorexia thread eventually got cut out of the novel.
Well, and yes, you have the coach house, you have the big estate, you have the changing relationships of people. The other thing that I found very interesting is the claustrophobia.
Yeah.
The fact that all of these people were mushed together in this case, reluctantly.
Right. You have this one huge mansion where we meet Z. She's one of the main characters in the first section of the book in 1999. And it's her mother who's living in this big house. Her mother offers her and her husband the coach house, but then really quickly moves another couple in there too without ever thinking to offer them space in the big house. That would never occur to her, right? And they're crammed together. They don't know each other very well. And they're moved into this tiny space. They're sharing a kitchen. They're sharing a living space. And of course, weird things happen. It's a weird house anyway. There are weird vibes there. People are unhappy. There's weird energy. But even in addition to that, just the sexual politics of two couples living in close proximity. A couple of them are out of work. They're hanging around the house together all day. They're not the two that are married to each other.
Of course.
Things happen.
Right. And there's also one is an artist, mm-hmm. and this house had been an artist colony.
Right.
And that's part of the history, which we learn right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a secret.
Right. We know we're going to be moving backwards in time over the course of this book. We start in 1999, then we go back to the 50s, then we go back to the 20s, when this estate was an artist colony in full swing, the kind of place where artists, writers, musicians would come and stay for a couple weeks, a couple months, and do their work. And these places are still around. There are some in the Midwest. But what's interesting to one of the characters in 1999, Z's husband, Doug, he's been trying since graduate school to write a book about this poet, Edwin Parfitt. And he knows that Edwin Parfitt once stayed at the colony. And he almost feels like as if by being so close to where Edwin Parfitt stayed, somehow magically that's going to help him write this, which of course is ridiculous until it's not.
When you were playing with these two couples and it turned in, you know, the anorexia thread went away and it turned into the 100-year house, did the idea of moving backward in time come with it, or was that something you always had in mind before you even started?
It came a little later, actually. So I had this idea of these two couples in this coach house, the big estate, maybe the idea that this house had been an artist's colony, the sense of some mystery in the background. And I realized that was going to be a novel. It wasn't a short story. And I started writing that as a novel. But I was going to have to leave a lot of things unanswered. They were going to bring up these mysteries of the past, wonder about them, try to find the files of the colony. And the ultimate message of the book was kind of going to be, well, we'll never know. And how unsatisfying is that? That real life is like that. And real life isn't always fun that way. I wanted to go down the rabbit hole. And I realized one day, I was brushing my teeth. I realized I could actually take them back in time. I could go back to the 50s when something kind of violent and cataclysmic happened. I could go back to the 20s when it was a colony. And at the very end, I could even go back to 1900 when the estate was being built. And that scared the hell out of me. I realized, you know, I was cutting out a lot more work for myself.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was like, oh, I'm almost done. I have the whole thing plotted out. And then I'm standing brushing my teeth going, wait, I could do this. And it's going to take me 3 more years to do it, but it was worth it.
I love the idea of going backward. The thing that kind of was melancholy for me is that knowing that the characters in that first section aren't ever going to know what I knew at the end of the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In a lot of ways, you know, it's a story that is in some ways a ghost story and in some ways not. No ghost is going to pop out at you. But there's always the question of ghosts, who's haunting the place. And one of the answers, I think, to that question is that we are the ghosts, the readers. We are the ones who have witnessed all of this history. We are the only ones who can put it together. And we're uniquely unable to convey that information to the people who need to know it. And that's the position a ghost is in. So, you know, there are other answers to that ghost story mystery, too, of who's haunting the house, who's pulling these people around. But one of the answers is us.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way before. But, yeah, we can't tell them. We can't go back to the beginning of the book and say, wait.
Right.
I know what's happening.
And how badly do we want to? And that's what we imagine ghosts are doing too, right? They have something they want to tell us. They know stuff we don't know. They've seen it all and they can't tell us.
Art plays a huge role here too, almost as important a role as the human characters. What art is, what we need to make it, what it needs in order to flourish. And of course, this is an artist colony, but it's a reluctant one.
Yeah. You know, when we start in 1999, we have Doug who's trying to write about a poet. And we have Miriam, the wife in this other couple, who is herself an artist. She's making collage out of sort of detritus, these weird mosaics. And Miriam has that energy, that same energy that the artist did back in 1929. And maybe that's the reason that things start to happen then in the house. It's the first time the house has really had an artist in it since the colony was shut down and turned back into a private residence. And, you know, people don't understand her art. They don't understand what she's doing. People don't even understand why Doug would be writing about a poet. People keep thinking he is a poet. So there's sort of this conflict between the artists and what they want to do and the people who've earned the money that have made this kind of place possible, often not the same people.
Usually not the same
Usually
people.
Not. Yeah. Usually not. Sometimes, you know, occasionally it is. And, yeah, when we go back to the 20s, we get this group of artists fighting for the colony's survival. The house has been turned into an artist's colony, but the DeVores, the family who owns the estate, still, even though it's a colony, are threatening to shut them down. And they're doing anything they can to keep it open. So it's very much a justification of art that's going on. They're fighting for the right and the need to produce their art, to show this person, this representative of the DeVore family who's come to shut them down, why it should stay open. And when that fails, they resort to some kind of fun foul play instead,
yes.
Actually.
Yes, and obviously things happen. I don't want to, again, don't want to give anything away. Lots of stuff happens. Why do you think, as a writer, I mean, you're an artist yourself, why is it so important to have a place like Laurel Field, which is the name of this fictitious artist colony?
Right. You know, for one thing, you know, artist colonies still exist, and I've stayed at three of them in the past few years. It's become especially important to me after I had kids. These colonies have in some ways leveled the playing field for female artists, for artists who are under hard economic times, who've maybe lost studio space. And honestly, a lot of it is for women or for men at this point who normally work from home with kids around. And to be able to get away for 2 weeks to get something done is huge. So and you think – I know a lot of artists who lost studio space after Hurricane Sandy in New York. And just to have a place to go and regroup, they'd lost years' worth of artwork. Then they were able to move into a place like Yaddo and McDowell and have a dry studio space for one thing that wasn't filled with mold, but to just start again, to have 2 months to work uninterrupted, funded. Their meals are taken care of. So it can be the tipping point, I think, into success for a lot of artists. And it can also be a place that rescues you from disaster. And for those of us who maybe aren't, you know, quite as desperate, it can just be a place where you can get away from daily life, from obligations, from children and work. But it's also the permission to work. It's the uninterrupted nature of it. And then it's the community.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, it seems to me that certainly in the book, but I would imagine in real artist colonies as well, part of it is that you come together at night.
Exactly.
And either talk about your work or don't talk about your work or listen to somebody else talk about theirs or just be together.
That's it. You have dinner together every night. So sometimes it's just a silly conversation, but very often you're hearing about someone's frustrations, about what someone's working on, their next project. Collaborations come about in really interesting ways. Sometimes, you know, you'll get two musicians who never would have collaborated. Like you'll get a baritone singer, composer, and a clarinetist. And they're sitting there going, yeah, let's do something together. And something crazy comes out of it. You also get to hear each other read or perform if those people want to share their work. And very often I've been at places where artists have opened up their studios and let us walk through. There was one artist who, if you read this book, you'll recognize his influence on it. When I was working on this, I was staying at Yaddo in upstate New York. And there was an artist there who smashed china every day. And it had to do with recording it and making it into music. It was absolutely beautiful. But every day I'd walk past him smashing teacups out on the tennis court, and then he'd be sweeping them up afterwards. So either he was breaking china or he was sweeping it up. That was already a theme going on, broken things, repaired things, people making things, making these mosaics in my book. But when I saw that, I felt like I had to use it more. It was an injection into the book of that idea, that shattering and reimaging, yeah.
And also sweeping up.
Yes.
There's some of that that's going on in here, too.
Very much.
There are various people who are left to sweep up the pieces.
Oh, absolutely. It's in many ways, thematically, it's a book about reinvention, about people whose lives have been shattered or left behind in various ways. And there are characters who choose suicide in this book, who leave their lives behind in a very dramatic, very unhappy way. But there are also characters who abandon their lives in equal measure, but absolutely rebuild them as someone else or in a different place. The colony that's been disbanded comes back together in 1999. It gets reformed. Towards the end of the book, there's a mention of an artist who's not really a major character, but who would break pottery and then glue it back together so that it would be, you know, fractured but whole. And that's really a sort of an analog for a lot of what's going on in terms of people's souls, I think, in the book.
Well, also, you know, if you talk to doctors, if like you break a leg, the bone where it knits together is actually stronger.
Right.
And so I think there's some of that, too, that all of these pieces get knitted back together in possibly different shapes, but I think it's stronger in the end.
Right. These are lives that people have chosen. They're new marriages in one case that people have chosen maybe under better circumstances than the happenstance sort of the first marriage. New identities that are very carefully crafted. So in a way, part of the message of the book is that the self that you choose or that you rebuild out of the ashes or out of the shards is better and stronger than what you were simply given to begin with.
How much of the idea of this Midwestern artist colony came from your own experience of growing up here and being on the North Shore and seeing, you know, houses and the architecture like this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All of it. You know, it's set north of Chicago, somewhere between Milwaukee and Chicago. And although I don't mention it by name in the book, I think most people familiar with the area would recognize it as Lake Forest, Illinois, which is still near where I live. I always qualify that by telling people I don't live in a mansion. you know, I drive past these estates when I'm doing errands, and I grew up driving past them and had friends sometimes who lived in them or babysat in them, even as I was solidly middle class as a child. So I've always had this fascination with these estates. And there is an artist colony in Lake Forest, Ragdale, which has a very different history from Laurel Field. It wasn't a colony until the 1980s. So really inverse chronology to what Laurel Field has. But I think anyone familiar with Ragdale would both recognize it and recognize that it's not really about Ragdale. But this gorgeous old house, these amazing grounds, sculpture everywhere. Sylvia Shaw Judson, who's the sculptor who made the Bird Girl statue that a lot of people know from the cover of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, it was her house. And her sculptures are still there. There's a copy of Bird Girl there, which is the most haunting statue. And you know, I couldn't resist putting female sculptors into the 1929 section of the book. And it's very much a nod to her. And not only was it influenced by my life on the North Shore, but I think this architectural setup of the grand house and then the coach house is in some ways a Midwestern phenomenon. I know that it exists elsewhere, but what you had in the Midwest and on the North Shore in particular was all of these estates built right around the turn of the 20th century. In response to the Haymarket riots in Chicago, all of these wealthy millionaires leaving the city, they were terrified of these mobs attacking capitalists, moving up to the suburbs and building these huge walled estates with all this money from the Industrial Revolution. And because they were built around the advent of the automobile and these people were wealthy, they had cars, they would have this coach house or carriage house for their cars and their chauffeur. Now, 100 years later, we still have them. And what are you going to do with that?
Now, you spent a year here, right, after school?
I did, yeah. When I graduated from college, I lived in St. Francis. And I loved it. And I was doing some teacher training work up there. And it was in this old, I hope this building is still there, but this old converted monastery right across from the lake that they were using for all different kinds of nonprofits. And one of them was this teacher training. And I would just wander through these hallways. And I loved the history of it. That was the kind of place that I could, you know, could write another novel just about that one building.
Well, maybe that's next.
Yeah, yeah. St. Francis Monastery.
There you go. Well, I'm hoping, before you get to that book, I'm hoping that we will hear something from 100 Year House. Where are we, and can you set it up, please?
I will. So if you've heard the rest of the interview, you should be in pretty good shape. We're in 1999, and we're in the Coach House. We're in the place where Zee and Doug, the original couple, have been living. Doug's the one trying to write about this poet, Edwin Parfit, who stayed at Laurel Field. Miriam and Case are the other couple who've moved in, and Miriam is the mosaic artist, and she's kind of nutty. And at this point, Doug doesn't really know what's going on with her. And he's found her on the sun porch where she works, and she's sobbing because she's just found out that John F. Kennedy Jr. has died. And she's taking it a little too personally for something that it was tragic but didn't affect her in real life. And what they're talking about here at the beginning is that Bruce, who lives in the big house with Zee's mother, Gracie, is preparing sort of maniacally for Y2K. He really feels like the apocalypse is coming. And Doug has just seen how he has been making the housekeeper buy bags and bags of table salt to store along with all these other canned goods. So I'll start reading there. "You must think I'm crazy," she said. "No, no, not at all. It's a sad event. That's horrible, that whole family. There was the one who just died on the skis, right? And now this, and he was the best one." She sniffed wetly. He wanted to leave, but she'd be hurt. So he said, "Did you see what Bruce is making Sophia do?" And told her about the salt for the end of the world. "Oh, he asked us to store the canned goods. Did you know that? He goes, 'You have all that room on the ground floor. How about we fill you up?' He's worried about mice in the basement at the big house." "Mice that bite through cans?" She smiled a little, which was a relief. "Apparently. I mean, I guess there's pasta boxes and stuff, and their pantries are packed, and he said the attic is full of old furniture and file cabinets Gracie won't throw out." He laughed, trying to make her laugh. "What files could Gracie need? I've never seen that woman touch a piece of paper that wasn't a note to the staff." "Maybe they're from that arts camp. He said the furniture was. He said there were at least 20 mattresses up there and headboards and dressers." "Really?" Doug had been leaning against the doorframe, but now he sat on the floor among the heaps of cloth and shredded magazines. The vague promise of some artifact of Edwin Parfit's had hit Doug in the solar plexus, and he felt like a man meeting his former lover on the street, someone he believed he'd forgotten, but whose overwhelming effect indicated otherwise. "Christ," he said. "Listen, you know, first of all, it wasn't an arts camp. It was a major arts colony. Okay, so no, a minor one, but extremely important, at least in the 20s. I mean, you're an artist. Charles DeMuth, Grant Wood, think what could be up there." "What do you mean, Charles DeMuth? He stayed here? I adore him. I mean, his stuff's in the attic." She looked as if he'd told her JFK Jr. had just swum to shore, shaken but still dreamy. "Potentially," he added. "But didn't artists do that? They'd leave paintings as payment?" She sunk her head again. "I don't know, Doug. This isn't what it sounded like with Bruce. He just said there were disgusting file cabinets and the furniture. If there were anything valuable, he'd know. But if someone like DeMuth just doodled on an envelope, Bruce would have no idea what that even was." Doug wasn't sure why he was trying to get Miriam interested, since he didn't want her messing this up for him. Maybe he was just irrationally insulted that she wasn't as excited as he was. He refrained from mentioning Parfit. If she'd been paying any attention that night at the big house, she'd have heard him say Parfit stayed there. But he left her to her collages and her weeping and asked her not to say anything about the files. "More secrets," she said. He couldn't read her tone. What fun.
Indeed, what fun. Rebecca Mackay, thank you so much for stopping by and reading from The 100 Year House.
Absolutely, thank you.
Rebecca Mackay reading from her newest novel, The 100 Year House. It's published by Viking. Mackay lives in Chicago and she'll appear at Boswell Book Company tonight. There is a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then return with an in-studio performance and conversation with Milwaukee singer-songwriter Joe Huber. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Singer-songwriter Joseph Huber spent 6 years on stage with Milwaukee's acclaimed streetgrass group, the 357 String Band. When the group broke up in 2011, Huber kept going. His third solo album, The Hanging Road, is just out, and Huber will start the Midwest tour later this month. Huber stopped by WUWM at night in July to chat with Trapper Shep about producing the album, his songwriting process, and his recent European tour. With an acoustic guitar and a suitcase kick drum, Huber performed three tunes from The Hanging Road, starting with the one we're hearing now, Same River Twice.
What do you say that you and I stand in the same river for the second time? 'Cause it's right today, only you and I. Making waves and fighting tides, standing in the same river for the second time. Standing in the same river for the second time.
This is WWM, and we are here with Joseph Huber, Milwaukee-based songwriter and woodworker. I want to welcome you again to the studio, Joe. Good to see you.
What's happening, Trapper?
What does a Same River Twice mean to you?
That's actually about 7 month period that me and my wife had split up over our we were together for 8 years before we married, and like right smack dab in the middle of that, we split up for a little while. And that was kind of like my song I wrote for her as a, like, hey, I was an idiot. And now let's, you know, let's try to, you know, jump into the same river twice and make it work this time. Like, kind of like, you know, it has like the fighting against the tide, fighting against the current kind of aspect to it. As in the famous phrase is no man can go in the same river twice. Mm-hmm. As in all is in flux, you can't go back. So this is kind of just like, well, forget that. Let's, you know, somehow we can do it. And we did, you know, we're married now, have been happily married for a year.
Congratulations.
So,
yeah.
So that was my Hey, Sorry I'm an Idiot song.
Your wife must be a fan of that song.
Oh, I think so, yeah. Anyone well, that's about her, actually, I'm pretty sure like 90% of my songs have somewhat been about her. So she's probably just like jaded about it. Like, yeah, there's another one about me now. So.
And the other 10% are about drinking, the road.
Yeah. So
well, you were in Europe earlier in the year with your wife?
Yep. Brought her along that time.
Sort of
in
a honeymoon.
March, I was.
Then.
Yeah, certainly.
The tour went well?
I haven't had many bad shows over there, certainly. There's more intimate ones, but there's still attentive people, you know. I haven't actually experienced this. I haven't been to the UK, but some friends of mine were just joking about when they went to the UK and they were talking to some people about, you know, just cool sounding American things like the roads or something that have like a mystique, like the name, like Highway, you know, mm-hmm. Route 66 or something, like everything that just an American, like folk music can happen here versus like in England where like the wording just wouldn't sound right. You can't just, you know, like what name of the roads just don't sound cool or something where you're so like maybe there's a, yeah, there is a mystique of just like names and history here that is they apply to folk music or something.
Well, the hospitality at the venues must be a lot different, too. It's not
that's like, excellent. So when I was in Philadelphia, like the guy that runs this place, and he has like a place that's like you eat here, you sleep above the bar, and he called it the European setup or something. It's like, yeah, that's exactly right. It's perfect. You get there and you load in and you're home. You don't need to go anywhere. Comfort and being home as soon as you walk into a place versus
two drink tickets
and good luck finding a hotel around here. You'll probably have to go outside of town, you know, find something affordable about 20 miles up the road.
I want to talk more about the production of the album in particular, mm-hmm. because one could listen to The Hanging Road. And when I did, I imagined a four-piece band playing in a dark mm-hmm. corner bar. But I come to later find out, of course, that it's a one-man production.
Yep. That's like six or seven of me in the morning drinking tea in my boxers or PJs. Yeah, just overdubbing myself here. So imagine seven of me in my boxers.
there are these spontaneous moments throughout the album, though, where it seems as if the band or the one-man band made possible by multi-track recording
mm-hmm.
Is just figuring out the songs for the first time.
Certainly.
Did pressing all the buttons yourself give you more freedom to learn and record on the fly in your boxers in the morning?
Mm-hmm. In my boxers in the morning. Yeah, having a complete control is something that's very freeing. You can, you know, if I, I think, you know, there's been times when we've recorded songs back in the day in 357 where it's just like, that was way too fast, that was way too slow, mm-hmm. you know, that like those problems just don't happen, you know.
The record sound is more akin to something you'd hear on an old anthology of American folk music than anything pegged as folk mm-hmm. on, you know, pop radio today. Was that a conscious production approach, or was it just, again, something that came naturally to you?
Kind of. I don't want to say it just like it's not what I'm going for because monetary issues of not being able to afford a better mic or a better system or something. But like, I like how it sounds.
It's
it
a
sounds,
primitive approach and, that yeah. complements the songwriting.
I think so. Actually, what is it? Someone asked me this in an interview that they thought that I wrote my bio and that in my kind of promo thing, and it says that my album has the necessary roughness of like, and I was just like, and when I read that, I was like, hey, what does that mean? What's this? What are you saying? You know, but in the last two records, I figured a lot of things out, and I feel like I've hit a point where I'm just like, okay, this sounds good. Like, this is, it sounds like me, you know, mm-hmm. and that's all you can go for, I guess. Yeah.
Can we hear another song?
Certainly can. What am I going to do here? This is more of a sentimental one here. This one's called Father, Why These Stones. I always say it's kind of a prodigal son story a little bit. It's like reaching a point in your life where you're kind of hit a certain low and you're trying to look back on or something to fall back on a little bit to save you a little bit, whether it's family or friends and things like that. And I'm a fairly impractical human being, and I often kind of like down on myself, like, man, what the hell went wrong with me kind of thing. So, and it's kind of for my dad a little bit, so... and family, I guess. So, Father, Why These Stones?
Oh, Father, why these stones? How they break our hearts? What do they mean? It's hard to tell. Born restless inside heaven's ungrateful gates, so he turned it all into hell. Now my branches once young and tender lay but a pile of dying embers. Father, why these stones? Father, why these stones? Well, the days rolled on in our homes we made under a slowly fading sun, and we drank our memories into their graves while we toast to all things young. Remember, brother, you and me, stealing excess to throw against the widest tree, and lightly we've run. How guiltless we've run. Well, our cups were filled and our doubts were still, as we laid down in our bed. So free of fear, so we toiled the years, composing ghosts inside our heads. Now as those youthful days do leave, now nothing more than the air we breathe, with sorrow in their stead. Only sorrow in their stead. Thank you.
how we stumble freely into the dark. Find our gods all made of stone. Leave our poor dear mothers with broken hearts, while our angels endlessly roam. And we took all our greatest chances on lost causes and faded glances. Took us far from home. Now I wanna go home. So we rob the graves of older days, just to see where we went wrong. And we speak their words and we walk their ways. And we sing loud old time songs, and we inscribe their words that give us rest on the tablet of our living breath as it carries us along. Won't you carry me along? Won't you carry me along?
Father, Why These Stones, live in Studio C. I was reminded in listening to that about your last interview here. You mentioned your dad saying to you at an early age, the best way to end your music career is to start one in woodworking.
Yeah.
And that you could pretty easily lose a finger.
Yeah.
Has he lightened up?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I think he likes my stuff now.
His whole house is filled with your cabinets and chairs and...
No, my mom definitely wants one to put in my room, though, so at home. So I might be working on that this wintertime for him. But no, I think he's lightened up a little bit about that. And he's certainly one of my biggest music fans, so I'm sure he's still worried about it a little bit. But
how has having your parents being supportive of you influenced your music career and your songs in particular?
Maybe that's why I'm not in a punk rock band right now, because my parents just supported my music no matter what I did so much. I had no one to be rebellious against, you know? Like, you're awesome. Just do it. Great. Like, thanks. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
What were some of the records that your dad was playing when you were growing up?
My dad likes a lot of pop music, actually. It was 60s pop. But I would say, like, the one probably that influenced me the most that I still listen to all the time this day is old 60s and 70s Jackson Browne. But otherwise, yeah, he listens to a lot of pop music that I'm not a fan of also. My dad likes 3 minutes and a good hook, and that's it, you know? So that's why he is always just like in my more morose songs. He's just like, people don't want to hear that. Just give him, you got to grab him. Just get, you know, get a good hook, 3 minutes, have it be done.
Don't bore us. Yeah, get to the chorus, as Tom yeah. Petty once said.
Nice, there you go. Yep, my dad would agree.
We also discussed last time about your woodworking and mm-hmm. how that informs your music. How did the pace of recording an album, particularly this album, compare to the pace of making say, a chair?
I would say in the furniture thing, there's still like a lot of creativity in designing it. But once you got the design, you know, it's just like production mode. Mm-hmm. And I just still feel like in the music and recording thing, like I never really entered production mode. I was always kind of just thinking, you know, the whole time about how this was going to sound. And, I wasn't prolifically just awesome at the recording stuff. So I'm constantly messing with things and learning as I go. And that's kind of how music is for me. I have to, I'm not the guy that sits down and says, all right, I'm going to write a song.
So of course the songwriting and woodworking are two separate creative outlets, but do you find that, when you finish a piece or finish a song, you get the same sort of accomplished feeling?
Yeah, I guess songwriting a little bit more once I've finished a song, because that I feel like there's something that's like a rarity.
Magic.
It's something about it that's just like, you know, sometimes I'll look back and I'll be like, I don't even know where that line came from. Okay, yeah. That's a good one, you know.
But with a piece of furniture, you can trace it back. You know, there was a tree.
And then everything is very tangible there, you know, versus there being some sort of ethereal aspect to mm-hmm. songwriting, you know, not to make it sound like I'm some prophet or anything. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to claim anything like that. I'm just a guy who writes songs. But yeah, there's still something fun when you can surprise yourself or just be like, I don't know what that was. Okay, that's good.
All right. Safe travels, Joseph Huber.
Thank you for the
tunes and conversation. Always
Certainly.
A pleasure.
Thank you for having me down again. I must have done something right the first time.
So do you want to do one more?
Certainly. Yeah. I'll do another one here. This is a kind of a broken love song. Not necessarily autobiographical in the contemporary time of my life here, but this one's called Coming Down From You.
Coming down from sitting on a rainbow over town. Now the tears come down, I think I'll go and maybe throw on a rainbow.
Singer-songwriter Joseph Huber performing his tune Coming Down From You in Lake Effect Studio C1. Huber's new album is called The Hanging Road, and he also performed Father, Why These Stones, and Same River Twice, also from that album. Huber spoke with WUWM at Night's Trapper Shep, and the interview first aired on that show in July. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We look forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
Now there you go. You're bending my soul like a heavy snow. Till that bending seeds to brick, and then I'm taking on a new load. Although I'm getting mighty used to coming down from you. Well, oh, waterfall, Lord, how I pleaded. Oh, but don't we all do what we